Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. seeks an international coalition to defeat Islamic State militants. A warning, the Ebola outbreak is causing enormous damage to West African economies. Sending relief supplies to West Africa in light of the Ebola crisis. Jakarta's new ethnic Chinese governor pushes for a new political culture. And Australia's flag carrier posts record losses. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The United States says it is seeking to build an international coalition to confront the threat posed by Islamic State militants in Syria and Iraq. VOA's Victor Beatty reports.
U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki says the United States is working to put together a coalition of countries in Europe, the Arab world, and beyond who might contribute to taking on the threat posed by IS Sunni militants. She says there are many ways to contribute.
There's humanitarian, military, intelligence, diplomatic, and we know this is an effort that is going to require significant focus and all hands on deck, not just the United States, but a range of countries. And you've already seen that there are a range of countries that have offered a range of assistance in Iraq, whether it's humanitarian assistance or other countries who have taken strikes. We've seen the efforts of Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, United Kingdom, and many, many others who have given assistance. And this is an effort that we think needs to be over the long term to take this on.
White House spokesman Josh Earnest said Wednesday President Obama and his team are closely monitoring U.S. military efforts against IS fighters in Iraq. U.S. attack and remotely piloted aircraft conducted three more strikes Wednesday against IS targets in the vicinity of Erbil and the Mosul Dam. But Earnest said U.S. military action is only one component of a comprehensive strategy against the Sunni militant group. He said an inclusive Iraqi government is a key component in the struggle against IS. He also said the United States is deeply engaged with regional governments who have a clear vested interest in the outcome of the fight. He says they can use their influence over Sunni tribal leaders in western Iraq and moderate political forces within the Syrian opposition to beat back the IS threat.
The United States is also in touch with our partners in Western Europe and around the globe to engage the international community in this effort.
Earnest says the president is speaking with countries that can and have demonstrated a willingness to play a constructive role in dealing with the IS challenge. He references the announcement by Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel Tuesday that seven European countries, Britain, Canada, Albania, Croatia, Denmark, Italy, and France, are providing urgently needed arms and equipment to the Iraqi Kurds in their battle with IS militants. Rick Brennan, a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation and a career U.S. Army officer, says specific countries have special roles to play.
The Turks need to get more serious about closing off their border and not allowing the ISIL fighters that are coming from places in Europe, the United States, Australia. We need to get the Saudis on board to start to turn down the amount of money that's going into the region. Same with Qataris. The Iraqis are going to have to play a much more dominant role of fighting ISIL and pushing them back.
Brennan says this is the beginning of a strategy that targets the military and economic supports of IS. Psaki Wednesday said the United States cannot yet confirm that a second American fighting for IS was killed in a reported firefight with elements of the Jabhat al-Nusra Front group Sunday near the Syrian city of Aleppo.
We've seen those reports. We're looking into it, but we don't have any independent confirmation at this point in time.
The United States Tuesday confirmed that 33-year-old Douglas MacArthur McCain was killed in a clash with fighters of the Syrian opposition. Psaki said a U.S. ambassador was appointed in March to lead an international effort to prevent foreign fighters from reaching the battlefield. White House spokesman Earnest says there are thousands of foreign fighters from up to 50 countries who have taken up arms in Syria with the IS group.
We are very concerned about the risk that those individuals pose to the 50 countries from which they traveled. In many cases, these are individuals that have Western passports. They have some freedom of movement in our modern transportation system. And we are working cooperatively with Interpol and other law enforcement agencies, as well as the Homeland Security agencies in countries throughout the West and in the region, to try to monitor the movements of these individuals and to mitigate the threat that they may face. These are individuals who've been radicalized. These are individuals who've received some military training. In some cases, they're battle-tested. And they've demonstrated, as Mr. McCain did, a willingness to die for their cause.
Ernest says it is an issue President Obama will take up with other world leaders at the opening of the UN General Assembly next month. Meanwhile, the mother of 31-year-old American freelance journalist Stephen Sotloff, missing for over a year, released a video Wednesday appealing directly to the head of IS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, to release her son, who has been threatened with death for U.S. airstrikes in Iraq.
I've learned that Islam teaches that no individual should be held responsible for the sins of others. Stephen has no control over the actions of the U.S. government. He's an innocent journalist. I've always learned that you, the caliph, can grant amnesty. I ask you to please release my child.
The appeal came a week after another American journalist, James Foldy, was beheaded in a video posted August 19th on the Internet. Ernest said the United States is committed to doing everything it can to recover and rescue Sotloff safely and as soon as possible. While he ruled out any ransom payment, he said the United States will not rule out another military rescue effort like the one attempted earlier this year to free all Americans held by militants in Syria. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
James Jeffrey is the former U.S. ambassador to Iraq from 2010 to 2012. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy about the growing threat from ISIS in its operational speed and strategic mobility.
First of all, ISIS has a certain amount of support and built on the support of the Sunni Arab populations of Syria and of Iraq, who to one or another degree are alienated or oppressed by their governments, by the Assad government in Syria and the Maliki government in Iraq. Secondly, they developed first-class fighting skills, fighting the Syrian army and particularly Hezbollah and Iraqi militias in Syria from 2012 to 2014. Thirdly, they were able to gain a tremendous amount of equipment, particularly from the Iraqi army when it fled Mosul. So you add all of these things together and you have a force that is quite capable, experienced, fairly large. It's well more than 10,000 people, and it has a lot of allies, and well-equipped. And it has a mission. It has it has a belief structure. Its belief is that it is going to create a caliphate and lead a jihad first against the region's Shia Muslims.
Do you agree with some analysts say that U.S. invasion of Iraq contributed to the eventual mix of militant jihadists and former Saddam Hussein's army officers?
It's true that the ISIS is a development from the al-Qaeda in Iraq. And al-Qaeda in Iraq under Zarqawi basically was formed in response to the American invasion. But the basic problem is this is not unique. Whether we're talking about Mali or Libya or the Sinai or the mountains of western Pakistan or Afghanistan or Yemen or Somalia, it is common throughout the Middle East that whenever there is any breakdown in authority for the al-Qaeda personnel, the al-Qaeda movement, to develop roots and to try to seize territory and to launch its terrorist campaigns. So what we have is a phenomenon far greater than the American invasion of Iraq.
But why Saddam Hussein's army officers would join militant jihadists when they have different objectives in Iraq?
The reason is that they were totally alienated by the Maliki government. That's the first thing. The second thing is, and that's understandable, the second thing less understandable is they basically feel that they are the majority sect in the Middle East. Therefore, they should rule in the land of the two rivers, the heart of the Middle East, Iraq, even though 80% of the population is either Shia, Arab, or Kurdish. And that's an underlying problem we have to look at. It's not just that this is an oppressed minority. It's also a group that has a long tradition of ruling and wants to, by any means possible, including making a pact literally with the devil, ISIS, to come back to power.
Was the U.S. response to ISIS advance too little, too late?
It's the benefit of being the United States is it's never too late. We saw that in Bosnia. We saw that in the invasion of Kuwait. We've seen that in Kosovo. The United States is taking effective action to stop the forward momentum of ISIS right now. The question I've posed and many others is, what is the president going to do to eliminate this threat to the international community? He's right to expect a more inclusive, more effective Iraqi government to be our partners on the ground. But what if we don't achieve that? What if, even if it's a more inclusive government, many of the Sunnis don't go along? Are we going to simply tolerate or try to contain, which is a word the president used on Monday, contain this threat? I think that would be a major mistake. Containment equals defeat.
But what does that mean in terms of areas controlled by ISIS now?
Well, what it means is we have to form a three-way coalition of people in the region who are willing to rise up against ISIS. And there are many Sunni Arabs in the regions that they control who are actually fighting against ISIS, who have tried to, tribes, urban groups and such. Secondly, in the case of Iraq, the Iraqi army, once it's under a better government. And thirdly, America, with its airstrikes, we saw how effective they were at the Mosul Dam, its logistics, its training, its advisory, and its counterterrorism capabilities and equipment.
James Jeffrey, the former U.S. ambassador to Iraq from 2010 to 2012. We hope to bring you more of his remarks tomorrow on International Edition. The head of the African Development Bank has warned the Ebola outbreak is causing enormous damage to West African economies as foreign businesses quit the region and international transport suspends services. ADB President Donald Kaburuka said in Freetown Wednesday, some economies may lose 4% of gross domestic product.
Revenues are down. Foreign exchange levels are down. Markets are not functioning. Airlines are not coming. Projects have been cancelled. Business people have left. That is very, very damaging. Now, add to that the fact that this rainy season and people are not farming. So prices are going up, price of produce, at a time when purchasing power is limited. You are increasing poverty.
Liberia has already indicated it will lower its 2014 growth forecast. A Sierra Leone official said his government will miss its target of exporting $200 million in diamonds this year, with miners afraid to report to work in the Ebola-impacted East. The ADB has pledged $60 million to train medical personnel and purchase supplies to combat Ebola. Meanwhile, the emergency coordinator of the medical aid group, Doctors Without Borders, also known by its French acronym MSF, says the number of cases of Ebola in Liberia is rising rapidly and overstretching its staff.
The numbers is going up rapidly, faster than what we thought, forcing us to adapt our plans and our strategy on a daily basis. It is really an extremely challenging situation for everyone. And MSF, we can't do more than we're doing now. We've opened this center a week ago. It's completely full today. We are desperately trying to get more beds. We have bulldozers and rub holes getting up. We're recruiting staff, we're training staff. But we would like to do much, much more, but our first priority needs to be the security and safety of our staff.
Lindis Hurum says the Liberian healthcare system has more or less broken down, with many facilities closed and staff afraid to go back to work. She says the region faces a humanitarian crisis that is worsening every day. Health organizations from around the world are sending supplies and specialists to the West African countries that are dealing with the Ebola outbreak. On a smaller scale, ordinary Americans and African expatriates living in the United States are doing the same. VOA's Carol Pearson reports.
Outside a home in Washington, a sign reads, Help Action Africa. Send supplies to Sierra Leone to fight Ebola. Inside, there are boxes filled with latex gloves, chlorine bleach, and other items. All are going to Sierra Leone to help in the effort to end the Ebola crisis. Chris Abulam of Action Africa organized the effort.
I was born on the African continent, and I continue to remain connected with the people on the mother continent.
Abulam also helps his neighbors connect with countries fighting Ebola. A Lutheran church donated the metal school desks because these desks can be disinfected and keep Ebola from spreading. Other churches raised money to ship the goods. The shipping company scaled back its fee to just cover the costs. And ordinary Americans contributed as well.
People came on the day we did our publicity here from North Carolina. They brought supplies. We have people from Virginia, from far away Maryland. People have responded very powerfully.
This container left the port of Baltimore and is due to arrive in Sierra Leone in early September. Action Africa, also is sending another shipment of medical supplies to Nigeria.
We have a group of 25 hospitals that are going to be working with those supplies, and most of it too is more at the preventive level to make sure that the kind of outbreak that we saw in Liberia, that we see in Sierra Leone, and you know, doesn't get to that level in Nigeria.
Eric Wowo came to the United States as a refugee from Liberia. He settled in Louisiana, where he's gathering supplies to help Liberians fight Ebola. Chlorine kills the Ebola virus, so people in West Africa mix it with water to wash their hands.
This could save a whole household in Liberia against the spread of Ebola. Liberia, this would be like $10, just one of these, which most families cannot afford.
Americans are donating soap, water, medical gloves, protective glasses, and the like.
The people from this area cannot go directly to Liberia, but they can do something to help in the process.
Wowo says these simple donations will help save hundreds of thousands of people. His goal is to send a shipment with food and medical supplies every month until the deadly virus is brought under control. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Indonesia is the world's third largest democracy, but few minorities are represented in the diverse nation's halls of power. One exception is Jakarta's straight-talking new governor. He tells Kate Lamb how he is spearheading a new political culture.
The beginning of Indonesia's transition to democratic rule began after the fall of former dictator Suharto in 1998. But some argue that it has taken more than a decade for that transformation to be reflected in the country's leadership, which had long come from the privileged elite. This year, two politicians considered outside that privileged class are making their mark. Joko Widodo or Jokowi, Jakarta's wildly popular governor, a common man politician from a humble background, is set to be installed as Indonesia's next president this October. That transition makes way for Basuki Cahaya Pranama, or Ahok, his no-nonsense, sometimes brash deputy governor, who will now assume the reins of Jakarta. As the first openly ethnic Chinese to lead the capital, Ahok says he has long fought against identity politics in the world's largest Muslim-majority nation.
If I use the perception of the common politic in Indonesia, I don't have the courage to join the politic in this island. I could not be elected.
Ahok first made a name for himself as regent in Bangka Belitung, an island province off Sumatra, before winning a seat in the national parliament in 2009. A double minority, Chinese and Christian, Ahok recalls being labelled a kafir or infidel when he first entered politics. Indonesia's ethnic Chinese minority, who have lived here for centuries, account for just over 1% of the population. While Chinese Indonesians are well known in business, few have entered politics. During the fall of Suharto, the minority group was brutally targeted in anti-Chinese riots, and the memories from that time are still vivid. Prominent businessman Sofyan Winandi says Ahok's success could reflect well on the ethnic Chinese, but he says it could also escalate underlying social envy toward the group.
This is my problem, because the sensitivity because of this Chinese community, because people are so jealous. They're always saying that, okay, Chinese is so successful in business, and now suddenly he likes to do some things in politics too. And all this things is not good economy, you know. You have to show that you are not ethnic Chinese, you are Indonesians, and do for the country.
Indonesia is an open and democratic society, but there is an underlying resentment towards the often wealthier ethnic Chinese. Several months ago, a smear campaign against President-elect Joko Widodo, for example, which falsely painted him as Christian and Chinese, significantly diminished his popularity and almost cost him the presidency. Leading the capital says Ahok is a chance for him to show that results and meritocracy trump identity politics.
Jakarta is very important for me to show I don't care you are Chinese descendant, what your religion. Mm. All the country needs is a patriot who wants to sacrifice for the people. No corruption, no except bribery, only obey the constitution.
Ahok has developed a reputation for his hardline stance on graft, firing corrupt officials and implementing measures to curb the use of bribes. He has also spoken out against religious intolerance and made tough decisions, such as relocating street vendors and boldly closing the notoriously debauched nightclub Stadium. In a recent interview with Voice of America, Ahok joked that such measures make him Jakarta's new godfather, a reference to the paternalistic crime bosses popularized by Hollywood.
The root of the Indonesian problem is corruption. Only that, very simple. You know, like a stadium, 18 yes. years, have a narcotic, everything. Mm-hmm. Like a Bongkaran Tanah Abang, prostitution, under mm-hmm. 20 years old women. Everybody know.
Yes.
Now, finish. Mm-hmm. We demolish all the Tanah Abang, Bongkaran, mm-hmm. including the narcotic. But now we are serious about this.
Yeah, I thought your move to close stadium was very interesting.
Yeah, that's why we call us a new godfather.
Jakarta's new governor is set to be installed next month and will remain in office until 2017. For VOA News, this is Kate Lamb, Jakarta.
Australia's national airline Qantas has posted full-year losses of $2.6 billion, its biggest ever annual loss. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports the development is likely to hasten efforts to allow foreign investment in the troubled carrier.
One of the world's most recognisable airlines has a proud history going back almost 100 years. But Qantas is in deep trouble. Soaring fuel costs and fierce competition have resulted in mass redundancies and huge financial losses. Results for this financial year, losses of $2.6 billion, are the worst in Qantas's history. The airline says the dismal figures are in part due to weak demand, the huge write-down on its international fleet, and costs associated with thousands of job cuts. Qantas Chief Executive Alan Joyce believes that the carrier is through the worst and will soon bounce back.
We believe that we've turned a corner and that we've given an outlook statement saying that this business will, we believe, subject to factors outside our control, get back into profits for the first half of this financial year. We've made major progress with our Qantas transformation program, which is delivering real benefits and turning the business around.
Qantas has an alliance with Dubai-based Emirates and wants the Australian government to relax regulations that limit foreign ownership of the airline to 49%. As travellers continue to desert Australia's national carrier. Passenger numbers are falling as the aviation market in Australia has become saturated. Qantas is facing relentless competition on both its international and domestic routes. The airline's chief executive says allowing greater foreign ownership could lead to more lucrative international partnerships. Paul Patterson, a professor of marketing at the University of New South Wales, believes that Qantas has failed to make the most of a famous brand.
There's four things in sort of branding theory that you've got to have a really successful brand. You've got to be different. I'm not quite sure Qantas is that different today. It's got to be relevant. It's got to resonate with your consumers. I think Qantas probably does with a certain segment of the market, but with the other segment of the market that wants price, cheaper airfares, Qantas doesn't resonate with them. They've got to be known for some sort of quality or value at least. And people have to understand them. I'm not quite sure people understand what Qantas stand for today.
Analysts say the financial results are so bad that the entire board of management should resign. Investors, however, seem far less worried. Following the chief executive's optimistic view of the firm's future, the carrier's shares rose in Australia by up to 8% in early trade. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On August 28, 1963, more than 250,000 demonstrators gathered on the Washington Mall to demand voting rights and equal opportunity for black Americans and to appeal for an end to racial segregation. The highlight of the gathering was a speech by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
On this date in 1981, the National Centers for Disease Control, noting a high incidence of Kaposi's sarcoma and pneumocystis in homosexual men, announced a medical task force had been formed to find out why. Soon, these symptoms would be recognized as the disorder we now know as AIDS. On August 28, 1996, the troubled 15-year marriage of Britain's Prince Charles and Princess Diana officially ended. On this date in 1850, German composer Richard Wagner's opera Lohengrin was performed for the first time. The opera was an immediate popular success. Perhaps you've heard this part of the opera before. Traditionally played at weddings, the bridal chorus is commonly known here as Here Comes the Bride. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has long been committed to economic development and food security in Africa. Through a variety of programs, the U.S. has worked with African partners to help develop more productive seeds and fertilizers so smallholder farmers can grow more nutritious foods, develop broader agricultural markets for those crops, provide extension services so farmers, especially women and girls, can learn the best technique to grow and store their crops, and develop sustainable, climate-smart agricultural strategies. That way, countries can feed their populations without depleting natural resources. The U.S. also provides billions of dollars in emergency food assistance each year, so vulnerable populations can recover from food security crises caused by conflict and natural disasters. Earlier this month, the United States took another step in this direction, announcing it will join a soon-to-be-established international alliance of governments, farm groups, civil society organizations, research bodies, businesses, and United Nations agencies, cooperating to promote climate-smart agriculture. That's an approach to increase farm productivity and resilience, especially among small-scale farmers who are subject to climate-related agricultural shocks, like droughts or floods, while also sharing with them knowledge on adaptation techniques and technologies, and mitigation of greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture. In the days following a meeting during the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit in Washington, where the U.S. Secretary of State announced the move, five African nations, Liberia, Niger, Malawi, Nigeria, and Tanzania, said they too would take part in the effort. More countries are expected to announce their participation in the coming months. The impact of global climate change is being felt around the world, and agricultural production in many places is at risk because of warmer temperatures, longer droughts, severe weather events, and less predictable rainfall patterns. This obviously affects farm production. But at the same time, some farming techniques increase the vulnerability of small-scale farmers to climatic shocks. Inefficient tools, inadequate seed varieties, or misguided farm management practices in many African nations have held back agricultural productivity significantly. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that between 1985 and 2008, farm output in sub-Saharan Africa increased by only about 2%. The Global Alliance for Climate Smart Agriculture, to be launched at a UN climate summit in New York on September 23rd, will be a collaborative effort that brings together nations, multinational organizations, the private sector, and civil society stakeholders to help farmers in Africa and around the world increase crop yields, incomes, food security, and nutrition, build shorter-term resilience and longer-term adaptation to the climate changes already happening, and, where possible, reduce or remove emissions of the greenhouse gases linked to agriculture and associated land use changes. The United States is a global leader in climate-smart agriculture, particularly through its Feed the Future and global climate change initiatives. We are committed to supporting our African partners as they work to unlock the potential of the African farm sector to feed people, create jobs, increase incomes, and strengthen their resilience to a changing climate.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.